I think they would have been left alone had it not been for a de facto criminal enterprise that they had become, actually, even before they came to Oregon.
Welcome to Pro Se, Law 360's weekly podcast. I'm your host, Amber McKinney. That was Robert Weaver talking about the fascinating Netflix series Wild Wild Country. He was a prosecutor at the center of the complicated tale of a free love cult that took over a ranch in Oregon, but clashed violently with local residents. The story is really a legal one, and Bob will answer our questions about what really happened. As always, I'm here with my co-host, Bill Donahue.
Hello, hello.
Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you so much.
You come back, and Alex is gone from today's show.
Alex is gone, which is good, because it gives me a moment to respond to, you know, some of the...
Before you respond, I will tell our listeners that during this segment about Wild Wild Country we have coming up, you will hear from Alex, because he and I did that interview a little earlier in the week together. He and I both binge-watched that show.
But the reason why Alex isn't here is because I challenged him to a duel...
And
one, because I demanded satisfaction after he played a video of me singing some karaoke on my birthday.
I have to say, I really enjoyed that.
I had a good time listening to it. I chuckled when I was listening to the show without the two of you.
So was it a karaoke duel? Is that what you challenge him to after that?
I don't know if I'd want to take Alex on in karaoke. He's got some pipes on him, as listeners of the show can tell.
Right.
But I mean... Look, I'm a man who respects copyright law, and Alex made an
Fair.
Unauthorized recording of a performance, and
did.
I have alerted the authorities, so, I mean, maybe he'll be arrested. Who knows?
Well, before that happens, let's talk about some big news
right.
that we want to get into. I know you have a big employment development you want to talk about.
Yeah, sort of something we've talked about a bunch on the podcast, sadly. This week, three Morrison & Foerster associates hit the firm with a $100 million class action that claims that the firm discriminates against women, particularly those who have taken maternity leave or are working mothers. It's, you know, filed against one of Big Law's most prestigious firms. It's like one of many similar cases that we've talked about on the show that allege that just really important law firms are sort of systemically discriminating against their female attorneys.
These are the kinds of stories we talk about on the show that really bum me out.
Yeah.
But it's important to get it out there and talk about what's going on. So tell us the details of this one.
Yeah. So it's the rough outlines are something we've heard before that, you know, that MOFO is an old boys club, that male attorneys, as well as female attorneys who don't take leave or don't have kids, are given significantly more access to partners, to all sorts of things that will, you know, help them move forward in their careers. And that these practices are the reason why women are very, very underrepresented at the highest ranks of the firm.
Okay, so that seems easy to grasp what the complaint is here mm-hmm. and the allegations, but don't most firms have policies about this kind of stuff?
Yeah, and like many of these cases that have been filed, the question here is not whether or not they had policies in place. They did. The question is whether they were enforcing those policies, whether there was this de facto sort of culture of disregarding the policies. So, you know, the suit says that they had these, quote, work-life programs that offered employees parental and adoption leave, parental transition time when they get back from leave, backup caregiving, mm-hmm. flexible work options, all sorts of stuff to you know, to help a working mother get back into the world, and that those ostensibly encourage female attorneys to take 6 months of leave and all sorts of other things.
But let me guess, if you take advantage of those policies, that's where the trouble, they say, begins.
Exactly, that people who take those are left behind. That's sort of the running theme of the whole
So it's almost like you get like a black mark.
Exactly.
That you're not dedicated or whatever.
A good quote on that front from the complaint is, "The reality for female attorneys, especially for those who have or wish to have children, is far from the firm's family-friendly facade. The firm, quote, may allow maternity leave on paper, but attorneys who use it are, quote, set up to fail."
Yeah, that's some pretty strong allegations.
Right, right.
So were there any other things in the complaint that sort of flesh out what it was like at the firm?
Right. Well, so that stuff is sort of firm-wide, but the attorneys who brought the case, the three associates, had some interesting anecdotes about sort of illustrating how this worked in practice. That one associate said that a supervising partner, and who was the person that they were supposed to be like their mentor at the firm, told her that on her first day that, quote, "We didn't realize you were a parent when we extended you the offer," and, quote, "Parents tend not to do well in this group."
Wow. I mean, that's pretty blatant.
Pretty straightforward, right. Another associate said that her supervising partner made it clear to her that the part-time option that the firm has in place, quote, "would be interpreted as a lack of interest in her career and in becoming a partner." In her performance review, that same attorney said that she was straight up told that she hadn't progressed because she had taken leave. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So another depressing one.
Exactly. And it comes at a time when we've seen a ton of these suits that Norton Rose, Proskauer Rose, Ogletree Deacons, Steptoe and Johnson, Greenberg Traurig, all have been hit with pretty similar suits. And we've talked about them on the show a bunch.
And a lot of those have been about the pay inequity.
Yeah.
Not as much just straight up.
Not as much
leave.
as, right. But it's in the same sort of.
Yeah.
And we've talked about it a lot, and a lot of folks in this world have talked about it a lot. The idea of why are women graduating from law school at equal rates? Why are they joining firms as associates at equal rates? Why are they moving up in the early levels of associates at equal rates? And then you look at the top levels and there's been no change. It's massively more men than women. So we're struggling to figure out why that's happening and why it can't be fixed. And these suits are happening in that context. So it's an interesting, they raise interesting questions when we're trying to fix these big systemic problems.
So Bill, I also want to talk about a big employment development that happened this
week.
It's just a big week for this.
Mm-hmm.
This one's out of California. The California Supreme Court has embraced a new standard to decide worker classification suits, which we've talked about a lot on the show. They've made it a more worker-friendly test.
Mm-hmm.
So more people are going to be employees, not independent contractors.
And that obviously has it's a big deal these days, because the status of whether or not someone's a contractor in the context of the gig economy and Uber and everyone else who's working in that world is a much bigger question than it maybe was 20 years ago.
And it's a particularly big deal in California, because you do have these big employers, a lot of the Silicon Valley type startups that will hire quote unquote independent contractors for
right.
And you mentioned some of the big ones like Uber, Grubhub, some of those others.
And it's also just such an enormous economy that where California goes, a lot of times the rest of the country follows.
Yeah. So let me tell you what happened this week. There was a case against a delivery company, Dynamex Operations West. So two of their delivery drivers filed a class action wage and hour suit. They filed it all the way back in 2005, said that they were reclassified as independent contractors, but nothing in their job really changed.
Right.
So they questioned why they weren't employees anymore.
Mm-hmm. Did you just want to pay us less?
That was their question.
Right.
So the California Supreme Court on Monday shot down the company's challenge to them certifying the class of delivery drivers in the suit.
Okay.
And when they did that, they adopted the state's Industrial Welfare Commission's definition of employment.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is it's a pretty easy test to meet. It's anyone's an employee if the business engages, suffers, or permits them to work as an employee.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty easy
just
to meet.
Much more cut and dry than
it is.
Right.
And the previous test that California had used for decades
mm-hmm.
was a multi-factor test. It was based on a state Supreme Court ruling, and it emphasized, like, does the employer control what you're doing?
Right.
And all these other factors
and
that
as,
had to be weighed out.
As we've talked about on the show, murkiness and uncertainty often favors the institution more so than the little guy.
Yeah. So the court actually directly commented on this. They said that using the suffer or permit to work test will, quote, "will provide greater clarity and consistency and less opportunity for manipulation than a test or standard that invariably requires the consideration and weighing of a significant number of disparate factors on a case-by-case basis."
Right. I mean, that's, and you can't, when you're an individual contractor, you can't make those calls when it's that super complicated question. When it's an easier test, it makes it so that you know whether or not you've been misclassified.
Yeah, so the new test, and it's used in a bunch of other jurisdictions, is called the ABC standard.
Mm-hmm. How's that work?
It presumes that all workers are employees unless a business can actively show that the worker is free from supervision, the work is performed outside of the usual place of business,
right,
and that the work is in an independently established trade, occupation, or business
mm-hmm.
that's the same in nature.
Right.
So it's really just literally ABC.
easy to remember.
Yeah.
Easy as ABC. 1, 2, 3.
So just to sort of circle back,
mm-hmm.
this one's a big deal because of what I said a few minutes ago. The previous test was the big multi-factor one. Was used for about 3 decades, so it's a sea change for the state.
Right.
This is important in California. And even when this case was percolating up to the state Supreme Court, there were a bunch of people that weighed in as amici in the case. So you had people like unions, like the SEIU and others saying like, yeah, they should definitely do this more straightforward test.
Yeah.
And then you had like the Chamber of Commerce and business groups saying the opposite. So real traditional battle lines were drawn there.
And as we said up top, that if Uber and if Lyft and if all these different companies that are now taking advantage of the idea that these aren't our employees, these are gig people, these are, you know, if it makes it easier for their employees to claim employment status, it definitely is going to increase their costs and force them to treat their employees a little bit differently.
Yeah. And I'd just like to leave us with a quote from Kevin Ruff, who is one of the attorneys who represented one of the driver workers in this in this suit. He said that it, quote, cannot be overstated in terms of the abuse of so-called independent contractor status in California.
Yeah.
And then he went on to say that people who are misclassified as independent contractors, who work basically without protections we all take for granted in labor and employment law, he called them a modern day surf class.
Yeah.
So that really puts it in stark perspective about how important this is to the California economy. Wild, Wild Country, Netflix's new docuseries, centers on a free love cult that tried to build a utopian society on a remote ranch in Oregon, setting off a series of clashes with local residents. It crescendos into a tale of some big crimes: bioterrorism, immigration fraud, wiretapping, and an assassination attempt targeting a U.S. attorney in Oregon. Featured in the story is Robert Weaver, who encountered the Rajneesh commune when he was assistant U.S. attorney for the District of Oregon. Bob, who now works at Garvey Schubert Bearer in Portland, is with us today to share a behind-the-scenes look at the story everyone is talking about. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So I just want to say up top for all of our listeners, everyone should know, big spoiler alerts throughout this segment if you haven't watched Wild Wild Country, because Bob was there for this action, so we're going to get into all the specifics. At the core of this is really a legal story that is unspooled through these interviews relating to the crimes that the cult perpetrated. Can you tell us when you first heard about this Rajneesh commune and how you got involved in the cases?
Well, the Rajneeshis came to Oregon in the summer of 1981. And in those days, the Immigration Service was a division of the Department of Justice, much like the FBI, but unlike the FBI, it was not a top-tier law enforcement agency, and they were principally responsible then for what they do at ICE now, which is to round up and deport what were described then and what we referred to then as illegal aliens. And there were, as I recall, two beleaguered INS criminal agents in the whole state of Oregon at the time. And in the U.S. Attorney's Office, because the INS had authority to deport people they determined to be here illegally, that we very rarely did a criminal case.
Right.
And so one in 1982, about 18 months after the Rajneeshis arrived at in Central Oregon, one of those agents, Tom Casey, came to see me. I was criminal chief, so I was gatekeeper in those days, and presented me with some evidence that a handful of Rajneeshis living on the ranch, Rancho Rajneesh, appeared to be here illegally, having engaged in sham marriages. So that was my first introduction, and I declined the prosecution because I told Tom that the Immigration Service has all the authority they need to deport them if, in fact, they're here illegally. And the U.S. Attorney's Office has more important things to do.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the documentary that, you know, you, like you just said, it wasn't quite rising to your level yet, but, you know, keep an eye on it, and if something more substantive comes up, then you'll proceed. I mean, when you first heard about it, I mean, did you have any inclination that it would explode into what it eventually did? Like, did any kind of alarm bell go off, or was it just like, oh, another thing that I have other things to do, and now I'm gonna you know, not focus on this right now.
So, Alex, to answer that question, shortly after I declined the case, the Immigration Service transferred to Oregon to handle the Rajneesh case.
Yeah.
One of the finest law enforcement agents I've ever had the privilege of working with, Joe Green. And after Joe took the case over, it just exploded.
Yeah, it started to get, in watching the documentary, it starts to get really almost fantastical. I mean, we've talked about the immigration stuff, which is an entry point that I think most people would sort of understand. But there was also this part about the bioterrorism, where they poisoned some 700 people with salmonella and salad bars to suppress voter turnout. There was the plot to bus in thousands of homeless people to register them to vote, drugging the beer served to them. There's wiretapping. And eventually we get all the way to assassination attempts, or at least plots, against Charles Turner, who was the U.S. attorney for Oregon. So as this started to unspool, did this all seem believable? I mean, it seems almost like it's of course a documentary now, because this feels like the things in a movie.
Right. Yes and no, Amber. You know, Wasco County, it has a population of 25,000 people, and it sits against the Columbia River right at the point where the high desert, Oregon high desert, ends. And so not much happens there. And so, but when I would hear reports of things like arson, or of the Planning Commission,
yeah,
and of the salmonella poisoning, my assumption was that the Rajneeshis had something to do with all of that, because by the time those things happened, there had been a very long and bitter feud between, I'm going to call county regulatory authorities, and the control group at the ranch.
Yeah.
You know, whether it was land use or building permits or things of that kind. So as unbelievable as many of these events sounded, that was my inclination, was that the Rajneeshis had something to do with it. And the busing of the homeless was a little more obvious than some of the others, because clearly what they were trying to do there was to pack the voter rolls and take over the county government.
I'm glad that you mentioned the sort of slow build and the context that you viewed those allegations in, because ultimately, in my view, my takeaway is that the documentary is about a great many things, but talking to you as part of the legal machinations here, I thought it was an interesting examination of when the law becomes necessary to like intervene in what is like a cultural breakdown. Because at the beginning, right, all you have is like some new neighbors who don't like each other very much, and they're not used to the way that one another operate. And, you know, there's some tension there, but that's, of course, not a crime. And like you say, it sort of simmers at the local level and the county level until it rises to your level. I mean, the real first big acceleration, at least as it's presented in the film, is, of course, the firebombing of a Rajneeshi-controlled hotel in Portland. And that sort of is at least framed as the main sort of agitating event. If that hadn't happened, do you think that these sort of like just sort of neighborly disputes would have eventually escalated to a federal case, or was it always kind of destined to be this way?
Yeah, I do. I think it was destined to be this way, and I think as horrible as the bombing of the Rajneesh Hotel was, it was a one-off incident, and it was an expression of probably some discrimination and frustration by the guy who did that. But I really reject, as you might imagine, entirely this concept of that there was discrimination going on, that was somehow behind what came to be the large federal criminal case. You know, there would be, of course, some predictable antipathy, because the commune was built on the Big Muddy Ranch, 64,000 acres in a remote part of Oregon, where the neighbors were ranchers and families of homesteaders and retired people.
Yeah.
But, you know, if nothing else, Oregonians are very tolerant. And in the early 80s, when you walked to lunch in Portland, you would run into Hare Krishnas and Moonies and Scientologists. And so these Rajneeshis just seemed to be another group of unique spiritual seekers, and I think they would have been left alone had it not been for a de facto criminal enterprise that they had become, actually, even before they came to Oregon. So if you just look at the immigration case before we get to the more serious crimes, what Joe Green was able to develop with my assistance and the assistance of my trial partner, Bill Youngman, was a conspiracy to defraud the United States that began back in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And the ashram in Pune was exploding, bursting at the seams because there were so many people there. Moreover, the government was attempting to revoke the ashram's tax-exempt status, and so they decided then that they were going to move lock, stock, and barrel this small city with its members, with Bhagwan, with his Rolls Royce, with his household goods, with crates and crates of tools and materials from this little city to Portland, or eventually to Central Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that required hundreds and hundreds of lies and a pattern of deception with the Immigration Service and Customs, beginning with Bhagwan's having applied for a temporary visa, knowing that he was never didn't want to ever come back to India, claiming that he needed surgery in the United States, needed to be in the United States for 2 or 3 months, and then at which time he was going to return to India. None of that was true. He was planning to live here permanently, and I don't know if you ever saw this, but once he got to the United States for this so-called back surgery, which never occurred, he needed to keep extending that temporary visa,
mm-hmm.
and used various ploys to do that. One, claiming some exemption as a religious leader. He was given the religious leader status, but not permanent residency status in the United States. So I think this was in 1984. We were all surprised to learn in a filing with the Immigration Service that he was now claiming that back when he was 5 years old, he was adopted by Ma Nan Sheila's father.
Oh, wow.
at the age of five, and since her father was a permanent resident, he was entitled to permanent resident status. So that case would have proceeded regardless of anything else. And then, of course, shortly before we returned that indictment, we learned of these more serious crimes at the time that Sheila left. But to your point, if it not had been this criminal enterprise, I believe they would have been left alone. But they were the protagonists.
So let's move on to the phase where some of these more serious things have occurred and come to the attention of you and other prosecutors. It seems to me that toward the end of things, you, as a prosecutor, got some essentially lucky breaks that helped in this case. So I'd like to talk about a couple of those. And the first one seems to be when Madnan Sheila fled to Germany. Bhagwan seemed to get really mad and then started basically inviting the FBI in to look at her criminality. Did you consider that to be a break in the case? Because if he'd stayed silent, would a lot of this not have come to light fully?
Ironically, at first, my sense of it was that it was a setback for us.
Oh, interesting.
So to set the time, she fled with several of the targets of the federal investigation, the immigration fraud case, within weeks before we were going to return the indictment. So it added another level of difficulty to my case because we had to figure out a way to do simultaneous arrest of the defendants on the ranch and Sheila and the defendants in Germany so as to prevent them, because they would have heard, even though this was pre-internet days, I am certain that had the Bhagwan been arrested on the ranch, Sheila would have heard of it instantly and beat feet to Switzerland, where she would have been unextraditable. But you are correct that when Bhagwan went public for the first time and threw her under the bus, the world was told about far more serious crimes.
Yeah.
You know, attempted murder, wiretap, arson. And at that point, a couple former AUSAs went onto the ranch and then coordinated the investigation with the FBI. But that's the first time that the FBI went onto the ranch.
And it seems like there was another lucky break when David Knapp, who in the documentary is referred to as KD, who was a prominent member of the group, when he basically flipped on the cult and started working with prosecutors. How integral was his testimony to the case?
It was very integral. We had by the time that KD came to us as a witness, we had the immigration case in the can and had a solid case on every one of those defendants. Where KD was helpful was on everything else, the arson, the attempted murder, the illegal wiretaps, the salmonella poisoning, because he was part of that inner circle. There are similarities between an organized crime case and how the control group at the ranch operated. Every day, Sheila alone would meet with Bhagwan for an hour or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only witnesses to those meetings would have been Bhagwan and Sheila or household employees. And then Sheila would meet with her very tight control group that included Shanti Bhadra and Pooja and some of the people that you see in the documentary. And that control group would then plan and execute these, what I would consider a series of horrible crimes. And for some, but not all of that, KD was in that circle. So in that respect, he was very helpful. His lawyer asked for, and we gave him, federal protection.
Yeah.
Whether he has stayed in that to this day, I don't know.
Probably the most dramatic moment comes near the end of the documentary, and it's when the feds are preparing. I wouldn't say raid. They're preparing to go back to Rajneeshpuram, and you're very aware that the group is heavily armed. That's well established in the film and through the facts of the case, and the tensions are very high, and that's made very clear. Can you kind of articulate for us what it was like in the moment while you were preparing to sort of dispatch federal agents to the ranch?
It was very stressful. I do think, and I would say the high stress period ran from it was very stressful for the last year or so because there were these threats being made to, the Antelope had been overtaken.
Yeah.
And that became Rajneeshpuram. There were threats made by Sheila and her control group to a number of neighbors there, as well as the county officials, as well as the feds, and they had been very aggressive to try to find out what was going on the criminal investigation that I was doing. But the real tension went up at the point at which Sheila fled and the Rajneesh went public.
Mm-hmm.
There is one aspect, I think, of the documentary that might be misleading, and that is that there was never any serious consideration given to asking the Oregon National Guard to invade the ranch and assist in executing the warrants.
Okay, that's clear. I mean, I'm glad to have you clear that up, because I mean, the thing is, the ghost of Jonestown kind of looms over this thing, both in the documentary and actually in real life. And then I was curious, just because the tensions were riding so high, whether or not the National Guard was going to go in a few years later. I'm curious to know what was going through your mind, when the whole situation in Waco went down. If you were thinking about what might have been in sort of a darker timeline for you, or did that sort mm-hmm. of did that bring back any kind of spooky memories for you?
PTSD event, yeah. As to Jonestown, I think all of those comparisons are off base. The Rajneeshis were, by and large, very well educated, often affluent, often self-indulgent people.
Okay.
In most cases, and Jonestown was the opposite of
right.
that. Waco, I would say that when the events took place in Waco, that was an invasion of that compound by the ATF. Yes, I told myself there, but for the grace of God, my agents and the agencies that I work with, we could have encountered this. Because as I say in that documentary, and I still believe today, they were heavily armed as a licensed police force.
Yeah, right.
An event that never should have been allowed to occur, but they were armed with numerous semi-automatic weapons, and they were going to protect Bhagwan, Sheila, and that control group before they were going to honor their law enforcement obligations. So, yeah, it was stressful.
I have one other question just about this deals with something that you might want to clear up in terms of how it was framed in the film, because it is suggested, though not explicitly stated, that after you captured the Bhagwan in Charlotte, there's a period of time of about 3 weeks before he was taken back to Oregon. And the way that the documentary is edited, it is hinted at that the sort of protracted nature of his journey was an intentional sort of strategy by your office to extract a guilty plea. Is that something you care to address?
Yes, I care to reject that.
Okay. Like I say, they don't come out and say it, but like it's suggested heavily.
No, I get the implication. The transportation of a prisoner who has been apprehended out of the district in which he is charged is entirely up to the United States Marshal Service.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a 3-day preliminary hearing in Charlotte. At the conclusion of that, the magistrate released some people altogether, released some people on their own recognizance to return to Portland, and held some people over to be transported by the Marshal Service back to Oregon. And Rajneesh himself was one of those, and may have been the only one of those, that was held in custody based on evidence of having tried to escape, you know, in the middle of the night. At that point, it's out of my hands, and it's out of the United States Attorney's hands. But it is not uncommon,
yeah.
And even today, it is not uncommon for that transportation of a prisoner across 4 time zones to take 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay.
And he did not go by bus. He went by airplane. But, you know, I saw the documentary about the decision to plead guilty and why they pled guilty. You know, at the time they made that decision, Alex, we had provided no discovery mm-hmm. to them.
Okay.
As I tell you, as I mentioned, I believe our case, we had a lock on him and every one of the co-defendants. That's why, in some respects, it took 2 years to build it, because I wanted that case to be bulletproof. Once they saw what we had on him and the other co-defendants, I would have been surprised if all of them didn't plead out.
Okay.
So as you, Bob, look back on this, and it's now been brought back to the forefront of pop culture, how does that feel? I think I just want to get a sense of what's it like to look back at this portion of your career in this documentary form.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I was thinking both not only in the context of that, but also the attention to Tonya Harding in the last several months, that the career trajectory for someone like me, who began their career at Maine Justice right out of law school, was to get into a U.S. Attorney's office after 4 or 5 years at Maine Justice. So I felt very fortunate to get into the U.S. Attorney's office in Portland. And when I announced that to my peers, they all felt sorry for me. because nothing interesting ever happens in Oregon, right?
Yeah.
And they were heading to garden spots like Newark and Baltimore and Philadelphia. And so, you know, I think this is just a matter of perspective. It is,
yeah.
It seems like Oregon, every 10 years or so, something unbelievably crazy happens.
Well, Bob, that actually leads me to my final question for you. You brought up that you had also represented Tonya Harding. That was also a big motion picture this past year. Bob, what else have you worked on that we should be waiting for the next movie or documentary to come out?
I don't know yet, but you know, Amber, if history, if Oregon history is any guide, we can all take comfort in the fact that as we're talking right now, this minute, something incredibly unbelievably stupid is occurring.
Well,
and it'll present itself in time.
And there's usually a legal entanglement that follows things like that.
Which is great, because we'll all join up again and talk about the next thing. Thanks so much for being with us, Bob. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks, Bob.
We have several people to thank for today's show, including our producers, Kelly Marcano and Stephen Trader, our guest, Bob Weaver, and our contributing reporter, Vin Guerrieri. Music for the show comes from Silent Partner and Little Glass Men. If you want to know more about anything we've talked about today, check out our website at law360.com/podcast. You can also find the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, and we'd love it if you left us a review. Thanks, and join us again next week.